Chapman Verse, ready to talk about books that have influenced us. I'm Carolyn.
Jeanette.
Marie.
And Michelle.
Okay. And Jeanette will have lots of literary news.
Yes.
Maybe.
I do. I've got some interesting stories this month. But first of all, do we have any Adelaide Plains news?
Yes, we do have Adelaide Plains news. What we have coming up, a special, special guest for our Gawler Poets at the Pub event. We've got a writing workshop happening first. And then after that, the guest will be presenter of the workshop. And that presenter is, I don't know, is that me? Yes, that's me.
Oh, yay!
Carolyn Gordon, president of Adelaide Plains Chapter Verse and the editor of Malinar Crossroad Chronicle.
We've also got the Festival of Words coming up July. So.
And we're going to be launching that one in May.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And literary news, there's been a lot of interesting things happen in literary news in the last month. Okay. The Perseverance Martian Landing Point has been named after sci-fi author Octavia E. Butler. There's been a lot of cancel culture, and I'm using inverted commas there, controversies. So there's uproar over the translation of Amanda Gorman's book of poetry when she chose actually a Dutch translator, Marieke Lucas Reinvold. Michelle's probably got a much better idea. She's
rolling in the Reinvold,
Who was forced to resign from the project because there was outcry that she was a white person, although she had been chosen by Amanda Gorman. She wrote a really beautiful poem about that, about, you know, tolerance and acceptance. But then a Catalan translator also was removed because it was considered that it was a male in this case, that he was an inappropriate person to translate. So
basically a poem on tolerance. Two people were intolerantly booted off, even though the person who wrote the poem on tolerance was happy with the people
That's questionable, I think. I get that it's having a white person translate is maybe not your optimal, but if there is nobody else that can do it well,
and if the writer is happy with that,
if the writer is happy, then that's
exactly.
It and that white being, person was very, very conscious of the fact that she was a white person.
Don't know what the full details of the Catalan.
Well, I heard her speaking, not the Catalan, but the other one.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter. We can't change these things.
No.
But we just be aware.
And another one that I probably much more sympathetic to is the controversy over the 6 Dr. Seuss books out of 30 or 40 that they're reprinting are considered inappropriate by his family, who say they don't correctly reflect his ethos in this modern age. Because when he wrote them, ideas have changed. He wouldn't want these books republished now if he was alive. They're republishing 37, and my actual real problem is, why are they republishing so many Dr. Seuss books? I know they're classics. I think it's wonderful that they republished the best, but how about publishing more new and upcoming writers as well that better reflect the ethos of today? So I don't have a problem with them not doing the 6. I think, fine. You know, yes, some books date, and especially children's books. I think it's really important to get the right message across to children. But the fact that it's caused so much outrage on both sides is what is insane, I think. Mm. It shouldn't be a problem. Nobody should.
I think it's about having open discussion. So one of the books, they banned it because a Chinese person was portrayed as holding chopsticks and wearing a Chinese hat, which Chinese people do hold chopsticks and wear Chinese hats. So I think...
he was called a Chinaman rather than anything else.
Yeah, but if you... those discussions where you might say, oh, isn't that interesting that that's how Chinese people were portrayed then? But I wonder how we would portray it now. Yeah, I think sometimes if we get too much into the whole banning of things that were written in the past... Mm. You can't change the history, but it can certainly...
Things change. You have to be aware of history.
You know, you've got to be aware of it. And I think that's where you can have the conversations about, isn't that interesting? Like now they have books where, you know, there's two dads or two mums or whatever, you know. But you wouldn't then ban every picture book that had a mother and a father and two children and say, well, you don't have a nuclear family. You would be going, is that interesting how most of the story is written back then? Mm. I just think it allows for discussion as opposed to changing.
Yes. Also, there's the point of how is showing someone wearing traditional clothing offensive? What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Must everyone dress like a Westerner? Is not that saying that Western dress is good and all other forms of dress are inferior and bad? Is that actually not a form of cultural imperialism?
Yeah. That's a good point. That's an excellent point.
The other point is that it's actually saying that only Western dress is acceptable and anything else is a sign of inferiority.
Yeah.
That strikes me as potentially very racist. Yeah.
When, especially when you look at Western dress in this day and age in Australia, really, truly?
Yeah, hello. And I guess I get really concerned when we get too banny about stuff, aren't we? Becoming the wowsers who are deciding what can and cannot. I think that's too much of directing people's thinking.
It's bullying. It ends up being bullying. Yeah. Like, basically, this girl was bullied about it. She didn't deserve to be bullied about having been chosen to translate that, and she got abuse.
Yeah.
And that's really offensive to abuse someone.
Yeah, just say we didn't appreciate that. And I mean, look, it's even like the Little House on the Prairie books where they're rewriting them. Well, I don't agree with that. I think that's a perfect example of saying, wow, imagine how dreadfully they used to speak about Indian people back then, but now we wouldn't dream of speaking about them like that now.
That's fine if there's an adult guiding. Like, I was given those books as a child. I had no discussion with any adult about them. It was there for me to, as reading, and as a child I was shocked. I was appalled by the racism in them, but there was nobody saying to me or having that discussion with me because I was a lone reader. I didn't share with any adult around me. And that's often the case. So it's fine if there's an adult that child is talking to and Michelle's pointing out.
But they're reading old books anyway. They're just quietly. I don't know very many kids will be picking up Little House on the Prairie. There's so many wonderful modern books that I think they would read the wonderful modern book and they would go back and read Little House on the Prairie, and whether they had an adult to speak to or not, they'd be going, what a strange way to speak.
Of most of the books I read as a kid, I think there was particular writers that really stood out to me. I'd say Mary Grant Bruce, Australian Billabong books, very racist. I wouldn't want to give those books to my kids.
Nina Blyton was dreadful.
And I was going to bring up Nina Blyton amongst most influential writers, but yes, she's shocking. And I loved her
books as a child.
Exactly. And when I read them to Samuel, we laughed. I said, listen to this. And in one of the books, she goes and they said to the children, you naughty little fat boy. And Samuel goes, it's horrible. I said, oh, no, but it actually was this really great discussion. I said,
I didn't read the Secret Seven books because I always felt like I was the one that they wouldn't be friends with, that was excluded from the gang.
Yeah.
And I knew full well that I would have been excluded from their gang. And so I always felt sorry for that poor boy that wanted to be part of the gang that they bullied.
Yeah.
They bullied that boy. She was like, bullied this boy because he's unfit and fat and it's horrible. Well, I was actually not sorry at all that the boys didn't want to read them. This is an amusing one. An American academic has dug up some research which suggests that a likeness of Shakespeare, which is his funeral likeness in his crypt in the church in Stratford-on-Avon, is actually probably done by somebody that knew him and is a correct likeness. The likeness has been described as looking like a self-satisfied pork butcher. And academics hate it because he's not handsome and glamorous in this likeness, but it was the one that was commissioned by him to go on his grave. So
that's hilarious. Probably what he looks like.
Hergé's heirs have sued an artist over Tintin Edward Hopper mashups. Edward Hopper did the cafe image, that's a really famous American cafe bar with the lights and nighttime. It's sort of American poster art. And they've said that they're inappropriate because they sexualized Tintin, which is fair enough. He was a kid's comic character.
I don't even know that. I thought Tintin was a boy anyway.
It's him having erotic encounters. Eroticized him, which...
No, but that's ridiculous.
So that was members of
his family. But once again, some discussion to be had with children. Exactly. It's going, why would you do this? This is ridiculous. Yeah.
Authors are concerned about a proposed takeover of Simon & Schuster by Penguin. So it sounds like Penguin is becoming about sole publisher in the market now and it's becoming a monopoly, which isn't good. Some writing by Douglas Adams. Apparently there's boxes and boxes and boxes of his writing, which was donated, I think, to Cambridge University.
Oh, wow.
A lot of diary and like letters and journals and stuff. And one of them was talking about his feelings towards writing showed that he considered writing to be torturous. He was stressed about having to write.
Don't we all? It's delicious torture.
I don't think he found it delicious torture. He was well known for not liking writing novels. He didn't want to write them. Pressured into writing them.
I didn't know that.
Because Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy began as a radio play.
Oh, okay.
He was a script writer, not a novel writer.
Oh, okay.
So he wrote the scripts, and that's what he enjoyed and was comfortable with. He didn't actually like writing novels, but because it was so popular, he was pressured to write the novels.
Oh.
A Polish writer, Jacob Zulczyk, and I have to apologise because I have no way of pronouncing that. He is facing a 10-year prison term for calling the president a moron on social media. The president being a Donald Trump supporter. And
the president of Poland.
Yes, yeah, he's very right-wing. Yeah, he's a bit of a holler. Yeah, again, that's one of the dangers.
Honesty
of being,
is the best defence. That's not in that country.
Yes, one would hope. And two deaths in the last month. Nawal El-Sadri, a trailblazing Egyptian writer and feminist author, died aged 89 years, and she'd written over 55 books, was a fierce opponent of the Egyptian government at times. And Norton Juster, the author of Phantom Tollbooth, died in the US aged 91. It's a, don't know if you know the book. I know we had it in our collection, but I don't think we ever read it. Anyone ever read it? But yeah, it's one of those
so many books
classics
in my collection that I haven't read. What is that lovely saying? The buying of books and the reading of books are two entirely different habits.
Yes. I like that. Yes. Indeed. Okay, so that's the roundup for the news for this month. So we will move on.
And a righteous tip is...
Well, it was Marie. So what have you been doing, Marie?
Okay, well, I've just started. Most days I go out to a cafe nearby and buy myself a mug of latte, and I just write poetry using my phone. And I found that the more that I do it, the more ideas that I get and the easier it is. And I just sort of am finding that I am making time in my day. Usually it's in the morning, you know, I have breakfast and then go and have a coffee, kind of as part of breakfast kind of thing, and do some writing.
Now, the fact that you're facing just a phone screen rather than the big blank screen or a blank piece of paper perhaps gives you more freedom to just do whatever.
Well, the really interesting thing that I found is one day I thought, oh, look, I'm going to take a notebook and a pen and I'm going to write old school instead of on my phone. I didn't have any ideas. I was sitting
there.
I was really surprised because years ago I always wrote, you know, on paper. And I'm sitting there thinking, why can't I think of anything to write about? Whereas normally the ideas just sort of come, you know.
Yeah.
They might not always be that good, but, you know, there's stuff happening that
but from
put
not
down.
Good ideas, you see, get something else that connects with it.
Yeah.
And suddenly, wow, that works. And you need as many influences as you can to really work your way into your head and come up with these wonderful things.
Yeah.
Just write.
Set a habit and a lovely one. Make it a lovely habit.
And the topic.
Yes. The topic is, after looking at influential books that have influenced the world or other writers, we're into about the books that have influenced us.
Well, I'll start with my little pile of books. I have brought along, at the moment I'm kind of writing a cozy murder mystery. I will be getting onto that, Michelle. Don't you worry about that. And I'm thinking about some of the reasons that I may have been influenced to go along that line is that we talked about Agatha Christie earlier, but this one, Sue Grafton, American woman, and I really, really enjoy her books. She's got the Kinsey Millhone mysteries. She's got almost an alphabet of them. It started out with A is for alibi, and then B is for burglar, C is for corpse, etc., etc. And I just really love reading them.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, I could do that. And her characters are real people. They seem like real people, and she seems like an actual real person. And she talks about her life and things not going well, and a job, and all these things. And it just seems like, hey, I can do that. She can do that. I can do that too. And I will. I'll be as famous as her if I only get this first book written. Then I'll go on to the next one. So that's me.
It was really interesting when you said that, the difference between what was my favourite books and what were the books that
influenced
me. So I think certainly as a kid, Little Women was my favourite, but it also did influence me a lot because the character of Jo kind of gave permission to be, you know, a strong, sassy woman, I think. So that was quite influential. But there's another book by Sherry Huber. That's the two of them. One of them's a book on Buddhism called There's Nothing Wrong With You by Sherry Huber. So that's a Buddhist book. So I do read about Buddhism, but she is an American Buddhist teacher, and it's an amazing book. It was really influential because she's also got that lovely way of, because, you know, obviously we have in Western society, we don't grow up with that kind of language of Buddhism. She's managed to kind of convert it in a way that is easy for a simple soul like myself to understand. And that was really influential because of the way she was able to portray Buddhist philosophy, which I'm very interested in. But another book, and I remember reading it, I think, for the first time when I was about 23, and it's a very, very famous book called Women Who Run With the Wolves.
Yep.
And by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, and I have bought that book. I've lent it to people. They haven't given it back for obvious reasons because it's fabulous. I've bought it for most of the young women in my life, and that book was really amazing. And what I like to do is every 10 years or so haul it out again and read it. So that's about Jungian philosophy and fairy tales. You know, the message behind the fairy tales and, of course, Jungian archetypes and stuff like that. And that was hugely influential because it was just this fabulous way of just thinking so differently. And what I love about it is I do haul it out every 10 years or so. And from reading it as a 24-year-old young mum to reading it as a, you know, mid-30s sort of thing with a teenager, and by this stage, you know, I've raised a child on my own and done all these things, to 40s, and now I've hit the 50, it's time to possibly haul it out again. What I love about it is you see the story so differently each time. So it's this beautiful way of kind of looking through your own. You know, I think I've hit the crone stage, so I'm very pleased to be at the crone stage.
I don't think I'm quite at the crone stage.
Certainly, and even some of the things that made no sense to me at 24, I'd get quite cross about, I now can see. So certainly influentially, I think that is a really amazing book. It is a really fantastic piece of feminist literature, if for no other reason. I love fairy tales and the reality of fairy tales.
I do.
And how they're all not Disney and sweetness and light, and how we learn our lessons through them. And yes, particularly one story I remember reading when I was 24, and it talked about, you know, Red Riding Hood who went out to the woods. And I was just recently on my own with a small child, and the story was about Red Riding Hood going out into the woods, and some people never go out into the woods, so they never learn their lessons. And I just remember that time going, well, I don't want to go in the woods. Who are these people who don't need to learn lessons? I want to be one of them, because I was just in that stage where I was really cross and I didn't want to be one of those people. And then you read it again when you're 34 and you appreciate the fact that you went out into the woods, because you recognise that it really supported you to make form a lot of different characteristics. And perhaps you were always that sort of person who would go out into the woods anyway.
Let me answer a counter book of fairy tales beside my bed.
Marie.
I didn't realise that this was more about books that have influenced us, so I'm not really prepared. Because I was thinking more of sort of just books that kind of been, I think, important.
That's kind of what we meant.
It's influenced important to you.
Because the book that I'd thought about was Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, which came out in 1970, and I read it back in the 70s, so I don't remember all the details.
Yes.
I've never read it, but I have praised it about it.
But, you know, it's interesting that some of the things that he was thinking they put into this sort of fiction book have come true, and others haven't, which is, but one of the big things being how much computers and that kind of technology, how important that is in our lives.
On that note, it's very interesting the way that a lot of science fiction books from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond, there are so many things there that are happening right now. Some of them that aren't happening right now, and you wonder why. Why are we driving flying cars yet? Surely we should be by now.
Justin was obsessed with flying cars, and he had a picture of a flying car up on his head. Now, one stage he wanted to invest lots of money into the flying car, because there was an American man that was developing them. And I said, no, sorry, but it quite literally is not going to get off the ground.
That idea appealed to so many people, you know. And as a child, like, I used to enjoy watching the Jetsons and stuff. The Jetsons, you know. So, yeah, that's one that hasn't happened, but there's And yours?
Well, I had to start with Enid Blyton. I disliked the Enid Blyton books a lot as an adult, but they were the books that made me want to be a writer. I loved them when I was a kid. They fit about 2 or 3 years from my escape. I lived in those books. You know, I had the imaginary string going through the living room. That was the tent under the dining room table. So that really impacted my childhood a lot. I already wanted to travel. I wanted to travel from the time I was about 4 years old. But I think that also amplified that desire to travel because, you know, the descriptions of the English countryside, the marshes and the mists and the amazing rocks and the castle, it's so different to where I grew up.
Mm.
It just sounds so much more interesting and exciting than dreary Ballarat. Oh, yes.
Well, it's freezing cold in winter.
And dreary. It was always dreary.
At least it's freezing cold in England too. So,
yeah. I actually went from Anna Blunt to Tolstoy.
Bit of a leap.
We got television. Dave was showing the BBC adaptation of War and Peace. I fell in love with it. I got the library, got the book in for me. I was in first form when I went in and asked for the book, and they got it in.
Oh, my gosh.
I realised as an adult rereading it, a lot of it influenced me a lot, my love of history, my love of politics, and questioning everything was influenced by Tolstoy. And the other one of fiction is got to be Timeless Land. Feminist Australian writer in the 40s.
Yes, you've spoken about.
She was the first person to research Australian history before any Australian history books were written. She spent like 10 years in the Mitchell Library doing all the...
Australian white history. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, no, not just white history.
Okay, yeah.
It begins with Bennelong watching the white fleet come in. So, okay, by today's standards, it's dated, but she tried to put herself into the mind of an Aboriginal watching the white fleet, and their horror, their shock, their disgust. It is seeing white society from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And how, to them, these people were barbaric. They were beating each other, putting human beings in chains, and the things they were doing were just barbaric. So it was a totally different perspective on white Australia. And I think for when she wrote it, that's incredibly radical.
Mm.
I think she deserves kudos for when she wrote it.
Yeah,
okay,
for sure.
You know, it wouldn't hold up by today's standards, but for when it was written, and it was an incredible attempt to shine a different light on the invasion, and it is. It comes across that way.
And so when was that first published?
Yeah.
What year?
It was 40s, 50s. There was a core group of very powerful Australian feminist writers, all left-wing. Eleanor Dark was one of them. It's Christina Steed and Kylie Tennant all wrote pretty interesting books around that period.
Oh, cool.
So it was first published in 1941.
Okay.
I think that the point that you were made about looking at the time when somebody is writing something or when they said something is incredibly important.
Context is the most important thing. Always.
That people would say, well, you know, you can't say that, you shouldn't. But they don't understand that when it was said or whatever, the attitudes and the beliefs and everything were very different from now. And in 50 years' time, I mean, people are going to look back at what we think now is really a modern and all the rest of it, the right way of seeing things. They're going to look back and go, oh, my gosh.
I look at stuff like, I completely agree with you, and I guess that's why I always think, be careful with the censorship, because in order to get to our point, let's look at that it is a journey of constant questioning, constant pushing.
Yeah. You can't just chuck everything out. You've got to question.
I think the cancel culture is as bad as the people who want to say the most ridiculous things.
Yep.
They're still trying to censor things that I think should be inflamed and spoken about. So I agree with you. I think that wonderful moving on. I mean, I think, you know, I look at my nieces who are so shocked that, you know, homosexuality was considered taboo when we were in school. Like, nobody spoke about it. And they're just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I think my granddaughter will look at things like, what do you mean you had to vote whether people could get married if they were from the same sex? What are you talking about? Even some of the young men I speak to, when you talk about some of the sexist behaviours and some of the things that have happened in the past, have gone, what? Really? Like, I think it's delightful. The more outraged they are, I think it's actually wonderful because it means that it is so far removed. But I do think we need those sorts of books, Jeanette. So you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah.
And we also need to be reminded of attitudes in the past and that where we've come from to make sure we never go back.
Yeah.
Indeed. So, and it helps you see the signs.
Yes, that's right. But I still think that her book is probably more progressive than a lot of what's written today.
And I know you've often spoken about how she really influenced. Yes. Yeah,
she
how
had a huge influence on
me. Which I think is wonderful.
Love the main character. She's a really strong, feisty woman that it's consistent with what a woman would have felt like and how she had to operate within the confines. Yeah. I really hate books that put this strong woman in the past that does things that no woman would have done in the past. She works within the confines of that society, but she finds her own path and she overcomes prejudice and, she ends up being a very strong person. And it's beautiful.
Mm.
And it took me through, you know, those early years of Australian history and changed perhaps my perception a little bit.
Mm.
It was a good reminder that Australia's a country that has two different countries within it.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so they were good. The other one, it's non-fiction and I didn't include it, but was, and I've talked about this too, A Testament of Youth, View of Britain, who's a British socialist feminist. That book influenced me hugely too when I was a teenager. But so, yeah.
Oakley Doakley, and now we need a word of the day.
Yes, and the word of the day
is Oakley Doakley.
I went with bug lug.
I love bug lugs. I had a woman at work who used to call everyone bug. Come on, bug lugs. These things are so gorgeous.
One dictionary reference, I had said it was an English word, a kind of slightly derogatory, version of mate. And Australia said it's a sort of lesser term than mate, but and claimed it was an Australian term. So whether it was Australian or English, I'm not sure.
Sounds more English than Australian to me, but what would I know?
I'd say it came from England to Australia, but was used a lot. But yes, it is a great term. I love bugalugs, so
bugalugs, bit of fun. And my friend certainly used it as a lovely term of endearment, never as a put down.
I think it's endearing, actually.
Yeah.
Come on, bugalugs. You'd use it for children, your own children.
Good word. Writing.
Yes.
I have a poem I would like to share.
Okay.
And this poem, the title is actually the title of my next poetry collection. And this poem is called Leonard Cohen is Dead. Leonard Cohen is dead. Never again will he perform his own songs live with that voice loaded up with him, his ideas, his words, his being, him. Yes, Leonard Cohen has died, But surely we need him here with us as we try to construct anew ways to do and say and effing be. We let him go, hidden inside a movie, a kid's movie for God's sake, him, with his voice of gravel, smoothed with silken tones and made afresh. Every single time we see that video of him in concert, giving his all, so we learn how to give our all to love, to life, to all that matters. Leonard Cohen has died, but I so wish he was here, still alive, still doing his thing over and over. His voice, his words, him. Leonard Cohen has died, but we'll live on as long as we all remember how much we loved him and he loved us, singing his heart out, giving himself, so he may be dead, but we all hold a piece of him alive somewhere in our head or heart or gut, somewhere inside and true.
There's a lot in that.
I kind of like that poem a lot. Yes, you may have realised that.
I thought you liked Leonard Cohen a lot. Favourite song, Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Yep.
By him.
Yep. Yeah, by him. I've heard it done well. I went and saw Lena and Woodley on Sunday night.
Oh, did
Woodley
you?
Did it.
Yes.
Not quite how Leonard Cohen would.
It soars above any other.
Yeah.
Because it's not silky smooth. It's not, because that song isn't silky smooth. It's got so many things in it. I'm hoping my poem's got some of what I feel about him. Thank you. Right,
go. Okay, I've got a poem that I wrote about 20 years ago, and I haven't...
Except for your 21st.
I have to explain that I wrote it about 20 years ago, because as I am reading it, you'll kind of go, oh, this is out of date. And I haven't changed it to keep up with the times, because I think that's kind of important. It's called 30 Years From Now.
Okay.
New technology means things keep changing every day. It seems that change is the only thing that is here to stay. We have to keep adapting. Sometimes I ask how. Wonder what life will be like 30 years from now. Will cures for the common cold and cancer have been found? Will overuse of pesticides have poisoned all the ground? Will planes, buses and trains travel twice as quick? Will Australia have become a republic? In our homes, will we still use toasters, stoves and radios? What about CD players, fridges and our videos? These familiar machines may all be out of date. Who knows? maybe the computer could meet the same fate. As I said, that you can pick, but we just don't use CD players now and videos and things.
I'm being lazy and just bought the book. I was looking for something about books and I found this bit, which I thought was interesting. Mariana had secretly joined the teachers' union. She urged me to join as well, but my position had already been jeopardised by the Decameron scandal, so I declined, feeling as though I had contracted something unspeakably vile. For the first time in my life, I was guilty of the sin of cowardice. The Decameron had been brought to the attention of the Australian reading public when it was banned by customs, who considered the moral welfare of the nation to be their special mandate. Numerous books by controversial writers, many more for political and moral reasons, were banned in the 30s. Works by Aldous Huxley, George Orwell and D.H. Lawrence, as well as older classics such as Moll Flanders, all failed to pass customs vigilantes. Copies of all of the above were interpolated through the piles of books gathering dust on my cell floor. On two previous occasions, I've been warned that books I had been seen with were unsuitable. Anna Karenina and Tessa de d'Urbervilles were reasonably innocuous compared to what I could have produced, had I still a mind to be contrary. I suspect that it was Gracie Smith who sparked the Decameron scandal. She came to my room in the guise of being friendly to elicit information regarding the activities of Mariana. Mariana has gone out. Indeed, it's her night off. I wonder where she went. I ignored her and continued working on papers I was correcting. Somehow she must have managed to extract a copy of the Decameron from one of my neglected piles of texts while I had my back turned, deliberately ignoring her. She had a rather knowing look on her face when she left after failing to elicit any further response from me. The offending literature was taken to Miss Y's office next morning and the woman's bleached face infused with blotched hues of rage. She called for me and informed me with an icy chill racking her ascetic voice that I was reading foul and indecent books written to satiate the lecheress. She questioned my fitness to train the minds of the innocent young. I've never read that particular volume, I pleaded, not dishonestly, for that copy belonged to Ambrose. It was the property of my departed guardian who acquired such books in an earnest endeavour to expand his cultural horizons. It was bequeathed to me along with many other books, which I keep in honour of his memory, though I've read very few of them. In that case, it would be a relief to all of us if this insidious pornography be removed from this building before it corrupts us all. I had no option but to agree and watch in compliant silence as she stuffed the book into the fire that burned without injecting any warmth into the rarefied atmosphere about it. 2 days later, I sent the unburned remainder of my books along with the treasured Buddha back to Neen Rory, cutting off the last links with my former self.
Well, I can see hints of your Agatha Christie childhood in that. Just listen to the clues and the hints about...
So, last of all, Reader's Challenge, and I had an idea for this one.
Oh, beauty.
That the women that have helped to make Gawler the great place it is, both past and present.
That's a lovely one. I've got something else to mention that I should have mentioned before. Yes. No, Adelaide Plains Poets, our writing group, the overarching group, have got a poetry competition happening. The theme is recovery. Entries close on the 2nd of July. And if anybody contacts me, I can send them the entry form guidelines.
Okay, well, I think that's it, isn't it?
Thank you.
Yep, see you next month.
Yep, see you.
I think that's, thank you.